You are listening to The News Project for the week of July 1st, 2019, brought to you by GNAT TV. This week's episode features stories about proper use of smoke detectors, the opening of summer farmers markets, an excerpt from the July 1st Londonderry Select Board meeting about the problematic emerald ash borer beetle, and the start of the summer season at local theaters and arts centers.
I got to show folks this. Okay, so, oh my God. So I have one of these in my house. So what is that?
We have several of those in our house. These are outlet strips. Very poorly made, very inexpensive. And for that reason, that's the reason the majority of us have them in our homes. However, this is what happens when they start to fail. Because they are made very inexpensively. They don't hold up when they get overloaded. And even though they have a switch on them, that typically won't trip. And then you're relying on the breakers in your house to trip. And depending on how old the wiring is, that may or may not happen.
Jamie, when you say overloaded, so if it has one, two, three, four...
Five, six.
And I put, so it says I can plug six things in.
Yeah.
Are you saying that maybe it's not a good idea?
It's not feasible, no. Not for these, specifically these cheaper outlet strips. There are much better outlet strips out there.
How do I know?
One, they're going to cost you a lot more. These are going to cost you $3 to $6.
Right.
You're going to get into $30, $35. But when you're plugging computers and
right.
big screen TVs and DVD players and all that in there, it's worth spending a little extra money. They've got more joules, so they'll take a bigger hit from an electrical overload.
Got it.
Whether it's from the power company or a lightning strike.
What was plugged into this one?
This was a fish tank. A pump, lights, heater. And over time, the homeowner smelt smoke a few times and never really figured out where it was coming from.
Right.
Until this happened, and then we were called. Fortunately, it only got a little bit of the wall and the fish tank stand, etc. The fish did not make it. It was hot enough that...
Do these things, the older they get, the more susceptible they get to burning up?
Heat and cold. As they heat up, drawing juice through them, then they cool down when they're not, that cycle will wear on the internal components. This was a house fire that we went to. This did work until we took the battery out because it was screaming, but the people were able to get out safely.
They
kept the fire small because they had early detection.
Right.
Called us quickly. We were there within, I think, like 6 minutes. We were on scene and kept it to one room. This is what a detector should do for you.
Right.
This should go away. And you are still here, so.
Let me ask you about age. Someone said, they asked me how old mine was because I was looking to get a new one. You know, I'm not even going to tell you because you're just going to curse me.
So the manufacturers are coming out with more and more smoke detectors, carbon monoxide detectors. They're putting the lithium batteries in them when they're claiming that they're good for 10 years.
Right, I read about that.
We have been out to numerous alarms with these new detectors because they're a year or 2 years old and they're going defective. I'm not sold on them yet. I think there still needs to be a little more work. Any detector is better than no detector, and we would rather come at 3 in the morning and have it be a faulty detector than... come at 6 in the morning when your house is fully involved and you're still inside it. Smoke detectors, their lifespan is typically 7 to 10 years, at which point they should be replaced, only because the sensor inside starts to wear down and then it doesn't pick up as
it
should. Batteries should be changed twice a year, at least once a year.
Does the price you pay for the unit dictate quality, like we were talking
about
the strips?
Not necessarily. I mean, they're
it's hard to say.
You can buy the $6 ones. They're going to work. They may not last as long. They'll be on the lower end of the scale, whereas the better ones will last you longer. But all of these don't work without that. And if you don't have one of these, that's not going to work. You're putting your life in jeopardy, your family's life in jeopardy, your home in jeopardy. They've got to have batteries. They've got to be working. We've been to too many fire calls where we get there. There's six smoke detectors in there, and not a single one has a battery. They're propped open. Even in apartment buildings where it is required by state law. It was chirping, so I took the battery out.
Right. It was irritating.
That's your life that's depending on that.
Do they have to be on the ceiling? Could they be on the wall and reachable?
So the thing was smoke as opposed to carbon monoxide. And carbon monoxide is another detector that is now being mandated to be put in new homes, apartments, things like that. That is as big a killer as fire. Carbon monoxide is the same weight as air. So it disperses, it goes everywhere. It can be, you can put your detector on the floor, it's going to come pick up as well there as it will up here.
Got it.
Smoke, on the other hand, is typically related to heat, and heat always rises.
So you got to put it on the ceiling.
So your detector needs to be at a higher location.
Do units come that can handle both, or do you need
Yes, they do make combination units, and quite honestly, we have a lot of them that go off. A lot of them now talk. They tell you which side of the detector is going off. Carbon monoxide present or smoke present. Evacuate the structure.
How many do you have in your house? Now, we talked about
extinguishers.
Downstairs.
I have four extinguishers. Right. Smoke detectors, one, two, three. I have six in my house.
Wow. Yep. So just for folks at home, strategically, where have you placed them?
So there's one in the basement.
For the dryer.
Correct.
That we talked about earlier, right.
The dryer and the oil burner.
Got it.
There are two on my main living structure and two upstairs. You don't want it in the kitchen directly above your stove, because every time you open the oven and little bit of smoke comes out or heat, it's going to set that off. Another problem we have is people put them right outside their bathrooms, and the steam from a shower can actually trigger that alarm
and piss you off, and then you
piss us off. We would prefer coming and making sure that it's nothing.
I mean the person, because now I can
individual.
See them removing the battery because it's chirping.
And then it's out because they forget it because they go get dressed and leave for work. Meanwhile, the toaster downstairs is catching fire and out the door they've gone.
Okay, strategic.
Or this outlet strip.
Yes, I mean, of all the things you've said today, this terrifies me now.
These are a very terrifying piece of equipment. I would highly recommend replacing those in your house if you have them.
Tomorrow.
Today.
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 Yep.
Any parting thoughts? Just do it.
Just do it. Make sure you have an escape plan. If one exit is blocked, have another one in mind. We have a lot of two-story homes around here, but if you open that window and you hang down, you're only 5 or 6 feet off the ground. Drop or jump. It's going to be better than staying in a room and getting yourself caught in the smoke and the fire. Close the doors. When you're leaving, close the bedroom doors. Close the bathroom door. Seal off as many areas as you can, because the less oxygen that a fire has to burn, the slower it's going to go, and it's going to stay more confined.
Okay.
We can help you more and save a lot more that way.
Cool. Thanks.
And other than that, just be safe.
Thanks, Jamie.
You're welcome.
Summer's here, and the time is right for getting back to the weekly farmer's market for some of your food and grocery needs. And for folks in the North Shire, those choices have been expanded even further, as a farmer's market in Arlington, now in its second year, has been added to the mix. That market is held on Friday afternoons from 4 to 7 p.m. through the summer and on through until September 6th. Jessica Roberts, the market's manager, gave us some of the background when we visited the market on its opening day on June 21st.
The community has just been so supportive. We've had a lot of people come and want to be vendors, and there's a lot of excitement. I have so many volunteers who want to help. So right now, the spirit is just really high in the market. I don't know if it'll stay that way, but for now, it's been terrific. I don't really have any complaints. We're excited about the market.
Now, you have a lot more vendors here this year than last year, it looks like.
We do. We had about 13 last year, and this year we have all 34 tables taken almost every week. So, and we've got some kids programs coming up, and we've got special days organized for this year. So we've got the live music every week. Just started behind me, so we're real excited about it.
I cried for you, a little darling. It breaks my heart to hear your name. And all my friends so love that you, my darling, they think that I am to blame.
So I really tried hard this year to get a mix of different kinds of foods. We have meat vendors and cheese vendors and veggie vendors and berry vendors. But we screen them. We have an 80-20 rule, so they have to have 80% of their market has to be agriculture. And it's a producer-only market. Everything they make, they have to grow or make themselves.
That market joins two others in the neighborhood that have been around for quite a while now in Dorset and Manchester. Dorset's farmers market runs year-round, and during the summer season now underway, it's held outside at the H.N. Williams store on Route 30. But it's not just about the freshly picked vegetables and fruits, home-baked breads and pastries, artisan cheeses, free-range eggs, and live music. There's also a healthy serving of arts and crafts, and that Vermont staple, maple syrup, available for purchase.
Let it be, let it be, let it be, let it be. Kind of till tomorrow.
And then there's the Manchester Farmers Market, located on Adams Park in downtown. It's held Thursday afternoons from 3 to 6 p.m., and will be there until October 3rd. Whether it's bread, cheese, vegetables, or more arts and crafts, plus some live local music, the Farmers Market is worth a visit. Karen Trubit of the True Love Farm, one of the vendors there, and there at several other markets as well, told us about what it's like on the other side of the vendor stall.
We love meeting people. And we, at the Manchester Market here in beautiful Manchester, Vermont, we meet a lot of travelers, but we also work with a lot of locals, and it's heartening to have great local regular customers, but it's also kind of fun to meet people from all over the world, so pretty neat. And there's also just a nice sense of exchange at the market, and people sharing recipe ideas. Customer was just here who had shared a recipe with me last week, and all week long I've been wanting to try the recipe, but I haven't yet. And it's just kind of I think it's a really nice form of culinary exchange and community building through that kind of informal sharing.
Krista Piccoli has managed the Manchester Farmers Market for several years and spoke about some of the challenges and how they screen their vendors.
A couple challenges. The main one is just vendor communication, talking with the vendors, figuring out scheduling needs, and getting everybody into the place that works best for their business. And then also just like neighborly relations. We have neighboring businesses, and there's always going to be some tension between some of them. And then we've got some that are really supportive of what we're doing. And so that's probably, those two things are probably the biggest challenges. So it's a producer-only market. So everything that you're selling, you had to have a direct hand in making. You can't resell somebody else's products. And it is open to anyone in Vermont and any neighboring states in neighboring counties to Vermont. So we have some vendors from New York, and they're from a neighboring county. And in terms of how vendors, the process of applying, there is an application. Craft vendors need to send in pictures of their products, and the board looks at them, and they approve, you know, they approve the craft vendors based on their craft, and food vendors based on whether or not they meet the rest of our criteria of being producer only.
A lot of work goes on behind the scenes for these vendors to get ready for the farmers markets. One of the vendors who maintains booths at all three of these markets is Earth Sky Time Farm, and on Thursday mornings, as they are getting ready for the Manchester's Farmers Market, their bakery and kitchen is a busy place as they prepare their items for sale. Bonnie Levis of Earth Sky Time tells us about it.
Basically, there's a lot of bread packing. There's a lot of produce packing for the markets that we take produce to. On Thursdays, we pack up the hummus for the week and for the weekend markets. We have, you know, an awesome crew that kind of is able to take things on and take responsibility and, you know, knows how to put out things in a beautiful way and interact with the customers. And we're lucky that we have folks that can do things like that, because Oliver and I couldn't ourselves do the 8 farmers markets a week that we now do. We make as much as we can, especially for the weekend markets, and usually sell out of that bread. On the Saturday markets, we're selling out at 11 and 12 o'clock in the morning for markets that start at 9 and 10 o'clock. So that's, you know, that's a good problem to have, I guess.
Several people we talked to said they enjoyed going to the markets as much for the experience, as well as to pick up a fresh loaf of bread or some vegetables or other locally grown produce. Vermont has several farmers markets, and there's one near you. One more summertime box to check off. For the GNET TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Things are moving along. There's been more findings in Vermont for infestations, and it's within 30 to 40 miles around us now. Known infestations is more likely even closer. I just drove through Ohio and New York State, and it's an eye-opener. Lots of ash out there, but they don't anymore. It's all dead. So a couple things. I'm working with some of the tree wardens in surrounding towns, and they're making recommendations to their select boards as well. The utilities, Green Mountain Power, their latest request for a rate up increase is partly due to emerald ash borer, so they're looking at it as a significant expense, and don't know what, you know, where we're going to fall with the utilities. We have 1,600 ash trees in town right-of-ways, and a lot of those are also in utility right-of-ways. I don't have a number on that, but it's still not clear at this point how much they'll take care of and how much we'll get stuck with. And couple of recommendations that I've seen, and one that I have, I threw out the idea of starting a reserve fund last year, and I still like that idea for a couple of reasons, but there's a couple of other ways to do it. One would be just, you know, putting an amount in the budget for tree removal. But the trouble with putting in the budget is if you don't use it that year, you lose it. Whereas a reserve fund, you can build up the funds, and then you can always dissolve the fund later if you don't use it. But I lean toward the reserve fund as far as money goes. Some of the other towns are just preemptively starting to take out their ash trees now. It's definitely going to be cheaper to do it sooner rather than later. And so in planning for the road crew trees that they figure they're going to take out, it's never too soon to start at this point. There's definitely going to be trees that the road crew's not going to want to do, and it's going to have to be done by tree companies. And once everything starts dying, they're going to get pretty busy and pretty expensive. So,
have you been monitoring the ash trees in the area? Town?
Well, it hasn't been discovered yet around here. I looked at a couple of trees in Dorset the other day that I looked at, and because it's there for the bug is there for 4 or 5 years before it even gets discovered sometimes.
But you have an idea where the ash trees are, where the problems are probably going to be in town.
Almost every road has ash trees, so there's some that have more than others. I don't have locations, but I think one of the things we should do is start locating the ones that are going to be problem trees.
Right. And I guess so I was going to go with that was if you could work in direct connection with Matthew. And
kind of the whole problem with it is by the time you realize that they're hit with it, they're pretty well gone, and then they're dangerous at that point anyway. So
That's why towns are starting to take them out while they're still healthy. Just knowing it's going to be a lot safer and cheaper than later.
Would it make sense to target ones that are definitely out of the right-of-way of the power lines? Because there is a possibility that there might be an overlap with their removal.
I would think so. I mean, we still don't know what their utilities are going to take care of, but definitely, Start with the ones that are
definitely away from the lines.
And the ones that definitely are hazard or lean over the road or whatever, stuff like that.
We had actually just had a meeting with state and Green Mountain Power officials 2 weeks ago, and the only time that the utilities are doing it is when it's in certified infected area, because it's the only way they can get their funding. Places up by like Montpelier and Bristol, they just found some in Bristol. Colchester. So if we don't have any hint, they're not going to come down here and just start taking trees because of funding. I think, I don't remember what the guy said, it was a few hundred thousand that they were just dedicated just to the Montpelier area.
The utilities, the Green Mountain Power, is probably looking at millions.
They're the guy said they were through the roof. They couldn't, they were scrambling.
So I think, I've thrown out a figure. I think I threw out a couple hundred thousand for the town if we had to take care of every tree. It could be a lot less than that. Trees that are in the right of way, but they lean away from the road and they're not a danger to anything, then, we can pick and choose to some extent. But
right.
Is there any state or federal programs to get any money for it?
Yep.
Not yet.
No. We're pretty low risk right now, and there's a lot of states that are
already in there.
They're toast.
So in terms of budget for this year, there's not really anything we can do, but we should certainly make a decision about it before budget talks start.
I'd like to have another talk this fall before budget time and decide whether. I'd like to see a reserve fund rather than a budget item, unless we're going to start doing work now.
So that's something that would be in the budget.
They really harped on was it's not an if but when kind of situation. It's not like it might happen, because there's no real telling it. Like you said, there's just 3-4 years before you even start. Maybe possibly telling that the trees are infected by that time.
And then they go really fast.
Yeah,
they die over like a 5-year period, but pretty much 10 years from now, we're going to be seeing dead trees.
It'd probably be a good idea for the road crew to start taking notes of ash trees that are not in the power companies right away and could easily be taken down if need be.
Yeah, I think that would be a good
place to start. Do you already have a list of some of the trees?
What's that?
Do you already have a list of trees that you can pass on?
No, I just did counts. Yeah. I drove like 60% of the roads and did counts.
Roadside mowing would be a great time to do that probably, because you're going slow enough where you can keep an eye out for it.
It's good to, as far as identifying the trees, leaves off is a lot easier. So, maybe this fall or winter, if there's a slow time to start, we could GPS the worst trees.
The state actually has I don't know if it's an app or something, but they do have some sort of system that they have that you can go around and plot them, and you get on their map system, and it highlights it. I got some of that stuff written down at the class that we went to. We share it with everybody once I figure out what it is, but off the top of my head, I don't have it. But they do have ways. There's other towns proactively, people are just driving around back roads and not necessarily counting, but estimating what kind of population we have. And I know ever since we had the class screaming its own tree, I noticed, so. We have quite a few.
Yeah, so it averages out to about 35 trees a mile of our town roads.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like we're pretty much at that point where we've sort of estimated it. Now we need to start narrowing it down a little bit.
Yeah.
The exact locations and...
Yeah.
The arrival of summer brings a burst of activity on the arts front and has long been one of the major attractions for visitors to Manchester and the surrounding communities. Each year brings something new, as well as the return of arts organizations that have been luring travelers here for decades. We started off in Dorset, where we stopped by the Dorset Playhouse, home to the Summer Dorset Theatre Festival, now in its 42nd year of offering professional summer theatre. We talked with Dina Janis, the theatre festival's artistic director, who gave us a rundown of what's coming.
But I would say, you know, we have four main stage plays, and after Private Lives, we go into our first of two world premieres, which is really thrilling for us to be doing two world premieres in one season. The first one is A Dig by Teresa Rebeck, who many in the region are familiar with. She's just an amazing playwright and someone we're so grateful to have involved with us over many years, and I know audiences here love her work. And to make it even better, she has a wonderful actor, Gordon Clapp, who's always been one of my favorite actors, actually, from NYPD Blue and other shows that people would recognize him from. I think of him a little bit like a modern-day Spencer Tracy. He's a fabulous actor, and he's in the production of Dig, and we're very excited about that. And then next up after Dig is a wonderful world premiere of a new play that we developed from the very beginning, Mrs. Christie by Heidi Armbruster, and that is really causing a lot of buzz as well. It's a really interesting play that is about the 10-day disappearance of Agatha Christie. So it appeals to our real Agatha Christie fan base, which we've always had here. Characters like Poirot and Marple are actually, as well as Agatha, in the play. But it's also a very interesting modern take on Christie and an interesting story. It's a real story that she disappeared for 10 days and no one has ever really quite figured out the answer to that mystery. So we're excited about that. And then we're finishing off our main stage with incredibly, very fortunate to do the second production. So it's a regional premiere of a fabulous comedy called Slow Food. And coincidentally, Perry Gilpin and Dan Butler, two of the original cast members from Frasier, are going to be doing a kind of Frasier reunion, acting in this piece with another wonderful actor. It's a fabulous piece, very funny, like just a modern-day comedy, kind of like a Carol Burnett-type skit almost.
From there, it was on to Manchester, where we met up with Ann Corso, the executive director of the Southern Vermont Arts Center. The center has several shows and events planned for the summer, in addition to a photography exhibit already on display at the Arts Center's Wilson Museum, which is where we held our conversation.
Well, we have an amazing lineup happening this summer. First is our exhibition series in our Wilson building. Right now, we have a terrific photography show installed, which is called Everything is Still, that really focuses on artists both domestically and internationally, who are using still photography but creating it out of motion picture film. So it's a very international exhibition, a really smart exhibition, and there has even been a documentary created particularly for this exhibition that really delves deep into the artists involved in the show as well as their process. Next up, later into the summer and early into the fall, we have a very different kind of exhibition, and that's called Contemporary American Regionalism with a Vermont focus. So that is artists that are working in drawing, painting, mixed media, large scale, small scale. So we're excited to have that exhibition coming up, and it is guest curated by Rick Cassini-Cadour. who is a well-known curator and I think culture maker, as he calls himself. So that's one for people to look forward to. And then here in the Wilson, we finally round things out at the end of the season with our first craft and artisan show, which will turn into a holiday market later in December. But that's just one of our exhibition venues is the Wilson Building. Over in Yester House, we have a variety of exhibitions, both group and solo, for our various artist members. Our annual member show is always a highlight of the season. A second series of solo exhibitions by many, many talented artists. And then finally, a juried exhibition that kind of rounds out the season over there. But perhaps most exciting of all is our performance lineup in the Arkell Pavilion. Every year we partner with the Manchester Music Festival that has a great series of concerts. But we are also offering a very different kind of lineup of our own. And so it really ranges from traditional to rock and roll. We have the Weight Band coming, along with Judy Collins and the Glenn Miller Orchestra, all happening in July, which will, I think, will all probably sell out. Then later in August, we have Let's Hang On, which is a Frankie Valli tribute, and then the fabulous Maxine Lenihan doing the Songs of U2 late in August. So there is an incredible roster of performances, exhibitions, and of course, as always here at Southern Vermont Arts Center, people can try their hand at making art as well, because we have a full schedule of adult classes and workshops and camps for kids.
And then it was on to the Festival House, home to the Manchester Music Festival, where we spoke with Adam Neiman, the music festival's artistic director, as the festival's 43rd season is poised to get underway. Here's some of what he told us about their coming summer season.
We have five chamber music concerts on Thursday evenings at the Arkell Pavilion at the Southern Vermont Arts Center. They remain our partner, our steadfast partner, in performances. And we also have two special events at the Arkell Pavilion as well. Our annual Night at the Opera, which takes place during our third week of the festival, and our orchestral evening, which concludes the festival. There's some exciting things to look forward to besides just glorious music week after week. First of all, we have on our opening night concert, July 11th, we have a world premiere performance of a commissioned work by Christopher Theofanidis. Christopher Theofanidis is a world-renowned composer. He chairs the composition faculty at the Aspen Music Festival. He's on the faculty of Yale University. He's won every award conceivable to a composer. And we're very privileged to have commissioned from him a clarinet quintet. That's clarinet plus string quartet. There are actually only two major works for that combination of instruments, one by Mozart and one by Brahms. And so by commissioning Theofanidis to write this work, we're hoping to really contribute something lasting to the legacy of chamber music repertoire. And this was made possible by an incredibly generous grant from the Hunter Trust, the charitable trust that endowed this commission. So we're very excited about that on opening night. That'll be joined by works by Schubert and Brahms and Schumann as well, with a Van Cliburn gold medalist headlining the cast, John Nakamatsu, among other great artists. Every other concert as well. It's, as I said, it's a star-studded cast, so the second concert features the Debussy String Quartet and Dvorak Dumky trios, two great works of the literature. The third week features the Elgar Piano Quintet. The fourth week features the Noble Archduke Trio by Beethoven. The fifth week chamber music concert features two monumental compositions, Bach's Goldberg Variations in the string trio arrangement, and Brahms' G minor piano quartet. Our opera night is going to be a great night. We have four singers from wonderful young artist programs around the globe, as well as a superstar from Mexico who is headlining the cast along with Warren Jones, the inimitable pianist. And then our final concert, our orchestral evening, will be, I think, a great success. Our concertmaster, Emily Daggett-Smith, will start the piece, start the program as soloist in Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending for violin and orchestra. Then I will be the piano soloist in Rachmaninoff's First Piano Concerto. And then the evening and festival will conclude with Brahms's Symphony No. 2 in D major with Ignat Solzhenitsyn conducting. So there's a lot to look forward to on the concert front. Then there are our weekend offerings. So this year we're partnering with the Manchester Community Library, and we're putting on a series of free events. So on Saturdays, we have two master classes in the morning and the early afternoon. These master classes are an opportunity to watch our faculty instruct our young artists, really to watch a performance go from excellent to outstanding through the guidance of these masterful teachers. And then in the late afternoon, we have what used to be our pre-concert recitals, which have now moved to Saturday. They're sort of pre-dinner recitals. That'll take place at 5:30 p.m. Generally, there's one evening that takes place at 4:30 p.m. But these free recitals will feature about 30 minutes of solo material by one of the featured artists from that week's concert, and this is also a free event to the public. And then on Sundays, our young artist performances. We have four chamber music performances by our amazing young artists. This year, we have a crop of 16. They are truly the creme de la creme. They come from the world's top conservatories. We had well over 100 applications from all over the globe, and these are really the top artists of the next generation. So these performances will be pretty much on par with what you're hearing from our established artists on our main concerts.
In our next segment, we'll continue to look at more of the several offerings coming our way this summer, provided by organizations like the Weston Playhouse, the Taconic Music Festival, and the Green Mountain Bluegrass Festival, returning for its second year in August. Stay tuned. For the GNAT TV News Project, I'm Andrew McKeever.
Thanks for listening local. For more local content, visit gnat.tv.